I want to talk now about contemporary challenges to theology and church life. And you'll see from as I work through the challenges, I am not really going to address directly theological issues. There are some serious theological problems out there. Somebody said to me earlier, well, providing you hit the new perspective on Paul and hit open theism, everybody here will love you. Well, I'm not in the game of hitting things really today like that. Partly, it's not that I don't think these things are extremely important. They are. And it's not that I don't think that they have profound and dramatic pastoral implications for ordinary people, because I think they do. It's that I think that on the whole, theology and theological debates, and this is not meant to relativize them at all, because I think they're crucial. You know, my life is devoted to them, I suppose, to a certain extent, but theology and theological debates can be the battlegrounds of those who have particularly the time to engage in them. And I'm working on the basis that the Tyndale Fellowship Associates, many of you do not have the time to engage in these debates. You're either involved full-time in direct Christian work, or you are those who have what I call legitimate jobs and are involved in your church as elders or lay workers in that kind of capacity. So what I want to address today are some issues that I think you need to think about, because they help explain some of the changes that are taking place. Not that they're, in some ways they can't be isolated from the more specifically theological debates I've mentioned, but it may well be that in your church, you know, I suspect most of us are more likely in our churches to wrestle with the kind of problems that I'm going to highlight today than we are with somebody, you know, who's read an obscure book on the new perspective on Paul and wants to recast the whole of church life in the light of that. So I'm really working on the basis of, I'm going to give you what I think are probably the priorities for church on the ground, not necessarily the priorities for the theological leadership of the church at this point. And also, I learned a long time ago, you learn the hard way. I learned the hard way that one should never speak too emphatically about things that you know have a limited knowledge of. So on those issues where I have limited knowledge, I only ever speak now in a fairly limited way. Contemporary challenges then to church life. I said earlier that one of the things that has really struck me over, I suppose I've been doing church history now for best part of two decades, and one of the things that has struck me, particularly looking at the kind of theology I look at, which is what I call pre-Enlightenment theology, 17th century and before, Reformation, Middle Ages, early church, what has struck me is how often the practical problems on the ground are not directly theological in terms of their origins and their manifestation. I mean, for example, take the Reformation. We often think the Reformation, well, that's the 16th, 17th century fight between Protestants and Catholics. And there's a sense in which that's true at a kind of macro level. But a lot of work has been done on local church history in the 16th and 17th century, particularly in the 17th century when church sessions and elder boards started to keep minutes of meetings that we have access to, that shows us that actually in churches, the battle carved up somewhat differently. And that, for example, if you're a Scottish Presbyterian minister in Fife in the 17th century, your problem was probably not that your parishioners were running off down the street to secretly take the Mass on a Sunday. Your problem was more likely to be that they were casting spells to make the milkmaid fall in love with them. And that there is a whole battle out there between what we might call, I would call sort of mainstream religion and folk religion, and that was just as fierce a battle in the 16th and 17th centuries as what we think of as the battle between Luther and the papacy. Difference is, of course, we have limited access to that particular struggle because you're dealing there with ordinary people, not the intellectual elite, who rarely wrote down their thoughts if they could read or write. So we get snapshots of their life through church records, minutes written by other people. So it's true to say that throughout church history, many of the problems I think that have affected pastors and church leadership are often not the ones that you'd find by looking at somebody's library, for example. Often a lot more complicated than that. And secondly, I want to make a point at the start that we must never romanticize the past. There is a great tendency always to think that the grass was greener 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. There was a book written on the history of evangelicalism recently. I won't say who it was written by, but I asked Paul Helm, the former professor of philosophy of religion at King's College London, what he thought of this book. And he said, it's an interesting book, he said, because I knew this man in the 50s and 60s. And he thought that the 50s and 60s were terrible. And we needed to go back to turn of the 20th century, 19th, 20th century. He said, now he's written this book much later in his life. And I think he said, I read it as the book written by a man who thinks, well, perhaps it wasn't quite as bad in the 50s and 60s as I thought it was. So we need to disabuse ourselves of the romanticizing of the past as well. If you go back and look at what pastors and church leaders are saying about their congregations 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago, same kind of complaints come up again and again and again. So two things at the start. Let's think more broadly than theology at this point, and let's not get trapped in the idea that the past was a better arena than the present. Often my grandparents used to say, oh, I'm glad I'm not growing up as a young person today when people get mugged on the streets. And I'm thinking, well, I'm glad I didn't grow up as a young person in the Second World War when I'd have been conscripted and sent off to die on the front. Yeah. It all depends where you're coming from. Sin is one of the universal constants in human history. And as a historian, I suppose what I'm interested in is seeing how sin manifests itself in particular individual and social processes at any given point in history. As far as I'm concerned, every era of history is a sinful era. The challenge to the historian is to say, well, why did people sin particularly in this way, if you like, at this particular point in time? Why was this the problem? Okay, they didn't have internet pornography 100 years ago, but that doesn't mean that people weren't just as wicked then and engaged in just as bad things then. They didn't have the opportunity to indulge in the particular sins that we now have, but they were there nonetheless. So contemporary challenges then, things I think that, you know, if one wants to put it in a pious theological way, the things about the society in which we live in, which human nature can latch onto as a way of subverting in some ways what I would call Protestant church culture. And I'm speaking unashamedly at this point as somebody who thinks that Protestant church culture on the whole is the way to go. Not that it's perfect, but it makes best sense of Scripture. First point, and I've harped on this many times before, the rise of visual culture. That's the first thing, I think, that has had a dramatic effect on the way people think about church and church life. I say it's the first thing I'm going to list. These things come out in no particular order. But the rise of visual culture, the impact of television on the way we think about reality. Television has transformed the way people think about the world. It's done that in various ways. One, it has prioritized appearance over words and argument. America is a superb example of this, and you see it, I think, happening in Britain. But in America, you watch a party political broadcast, and I cannot tell from the party political broadcasts I see which party the person stands for. And in America, generally speaking, they don't tell you which party they stand for on the party political broadcasts. Why don't they do that? Because it's all about projecting an image. It's all about mum's apple pie. It's all about the kind of folksy wisdom that strikes a chord with middle America. It's not about nationalization versus private industry. It's only about tax rates. If somebody's made a promise on tax, they fail to fulfill. It's not ideological in that direct way. It's very much, does the person appear to be the kind of all-American boy we can trust in the Senate or in the presidency? I remember a friend of mine, he happens to be a very left-wing Catholic, emailing me in 2004 to say, I hope you're sort of, you know, battening down the hatches for a Bush victory. And I emailed back and said, "Guy, surely the guy's unelectable for a second term." But those of you who know, it's a joke to think that he wasn't unelectable. He swept it. And the reason was, of course, I was bringing British categories of what looks like a persuasive politician to bear in a culture that's far beyond British categories. And I say far beyond, that's not a statement, pejorative or otherwise, it just means it's well away. The rise of visual culture, the rise of television, has prioritized image over argument. And you see that, I think, impacting, you see the straightforward impact of that on the evangelical church in the rise of sort of evangelical superstardom. certain places. Good example to me would be Jonathan Aitken a few years ago. When Jonathan Aitken was converted, he was immediately grabbed hold of and put out on the speaker circuit. My thoughts are, Jonathan Aitken's been converted, then he needs to be, as a young Christian, to be carefully nurtured and protected from this kind of exposure. But the sort of evangelical culture we have latches onto the big names. And because they're big names in the broader culture, because they look good on telly, because they have an in to the media, they immediately become significant players. And it's, very simply, it's a triumphing of image over argument. Aitken presumably knew very little theology at that point. I've not followed his progress since, so I can't comment on him now. But at that point, presumably he knew little more than he was a sinner and Jesus Christ had forgiven his sins, which is great. That's a great testimony. But it does not qualify you to become a spokesman for the Christian church at that point. So the rise of visual culture, very significant. And it will only, I think, this will only get worse in years to come. As I've talked about, the kind of the surreptitious level at which it affects the way we think about the world, who we think are the effective individuals. I wrote an essay a few years ago, and I used the example, I was not around for this, it's before my time, but the famous debate between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon in 1960, where it all depended on whether you saw it on television or heard it on the radio as to who you thought won. Nixon had better arguments. Those who listened on the radio thought that Nixon had aced it. Nixon had just come out of hospital. He looked terrible. I mean, he didn't look good at the best of times from the sort of pictures I've seen of him, but he looked particularly terrible on this night. Kennedy had just come back from a holiday. He was tanned, he was cool, he was young, he was good-looking. Those who watched on television thought Kennedy had won. That, in some ways, is the sort of the moment at which you see the kind of the modern era being born. If you want to sort of put a date and a time to it, that's the point, if you like, at which the visual nature of politics becomes so critical, when the visual nature of culture becomes so powerful. And in a more malicious and an obscene way, of course, the rise of internet pornography. Those of you in pastoral ministry, somebody was telling me just the other week at the seminary, they said, you know, if you chat to any group of men today, 6 out of 10 of them will have looked at pornography on the internet in the last 2 weeks. Stunning statistic. And I said, well, I said to him, what are the statistics among Christians? And he said, I don't know, he said, but I presume it's a higher proportion than 6 out of 10 from my experience in the pastorate. Pretty devastating. Again, you know, that's almost an aside to my main point this morning, but contemporary challenge to church life, visual culture in general, internet pornography in particular. I don't know what it's like here, but in America, internet pornography is the number one pastoral problem in the church at the moment, doing incredible damage. Linked with the rise of visual culture, I think, is the rise of consumer culture. My left-wing Catholic friend, who's really a Marxist, I think, he says, doesn't like to use the language of consumerism. He says it's a coded way of talking about capitalism without appearing to be a Marxist. But the impact of consumerism. What is consumerism? Well, consumerism, I think, is that ideology that has so taken hold in the West that we are what we can buy, to put it simply. And there are various aspects of that that should be profoundly disturbing from a church perspective. We are what we buy. Most disturbing, of course, is it places me right at the center of my universe. Remember my grandfather, talking to my grandfather, and what kind of values did he embody? Well, he wasn't a Christian, but for my grandfather, the key things in his life were, you know, he was a relatively poor and humble individual. The key thing in his life was, could he provide for his family? His value, his sense of worth, his sense of identity was rooted entirely in what might call an outward direction. His ambitions, if you like, were not for himself. They were to make sure that his family got a good start in life, always had food on the table, always had shoes on their feet. Cut to the present day, you know, if you ask me, well, what is it that drives you? I'd have to be honest and say, well, it's, you know, providing for my family. I kind of take that as a given. What makes my identity is what I do, who I am. I stand at the center of my universe in a way that my grandfather never appeared to stand quite at the center of his universe. And consumerism plays to that in a radical way. And it has an impact on the church in a whole variety of different ways. I think it leads to a transformation in the whole notion of authority. One of the things I'm going to highlight a little bit later on is, I think one of the major crises in the church today, one of the major threats to church life is, it is no longer possible to have a coherent understanding of church discipline. And one of the reasons why it's no longer possible is, discipline requires that I acknowledge something beyond myself as determinative of who I am and how I can behave. And a society whose economy is built on endless consumer expansion continually and quietly reminds me that I'm at the center of my universe. And although it's an illusion, I think, reminds me that I am in control of all that I say and do. So I think it has implications for church discipline. We'll come back to that a little bit later on. I think it also allows for us to avoid facing who we really are. I was very struck recently, maybe about a year ago, there was a woman appeared on the television, on one of the news channels I was watching, who was a very intelligent woman. She was a very successful stockbroker, I think, something like that, or investment banker in New York. She was married. And her life had fallen apart because she'd got to the point where she was spending 18 hours a day on the internet buying things. And she'd just run up, she'd run up debts greater than the mortgage on my house, on her credit card. I can't imagine what the interest payments would be. But what fascinated me about this woman was that most of the stuff she bought, she left unopened in her house. That she was constantly buying this stuff, but it was just lying around the house unopened in boxes. And that got me thinking about the whole shopping consumer thing. I'd always thought that it was about buying stuff, buying things. If you like, if you wrote that sentence out, the accent is on the things. That's what you're interested in doing. That consumerism is all about me getting an identity because I drive a flash car. I don't. I have a wife who always makes me buy the cheapest car on the lot. I did say, if ever I had the money, could I buy a sports car? And she said, no, we buy the cheapest car on the lot and you put the money in the bank. But I'd always thought consumerism was about me buying things in order that I can kind of show those things off as examples of how successful I've become. But this woman kind of forced me to reconsider that. The accent in consumerism is not on buying stuff, it's on buying stuff. But what this woman was doing was filling her empty life with the action of buying. And I thought, you can cast that in a theological language. I don't think it's pushing it too far. I said, what do I do when I buy something? I am God. I take a meaningless piece of plastic out of my wallet, or an intrinsically worthless piece of paper out of my wallet, and I turn it into something. I hand over the paper, and if I can use Catholic terminology, if you like, I transubstantiate it into a book, or a car, or a house, or a holiday. And I get a kick out of that power. Consumerism makes me God, not just because it puts me at the center of the universe, but it allows me to fill my life with this illusion of tremendous power. Why did this woman buy all this stuff and leave it lying around her house? Partly, she got a kick out of it. She played God. She typed a few numbers into her web page and bang, next day, as if by magic, a box appears at the door. I think there's more to it than that. What else in this woman's life was being done, as I say? She was filling her empty life, distracting herself from realities. What do we do when we're bored on a Saturday afternoon? Let's go to the shops. Not particularly we need to buy, we go to the shops. Surf the internet looking for something to buy. Pascal in the 17th century, the Catholic philosopher, he said, we fill our lives with rubbish in order to stop facing realities. He raises this lovely analogy. He said, why do kings have jesters? Why does a king have a jester? Kings have everything they want. They're supremely powerful. They have power and life and death over the whole realm. So why bother? Why is the person who sits closest to the king this professional idiot? And Pascal says, the reason is this. King has everything he wants. So what's he going to do if he sits around all day? Well, the only thing left to worry about is death itself. The only thing left to worry about is death and the judgment to follow. So what does he do? He employs somebody. He employs somebody to fill the rest of his life with distracting junk so that he never has to think about that issue. Why are people so hard to the gospel today? Well, one could say on one level, it's because people are always hard to the gospel. But why specifically are they hard to the gospel in the particular ways they are? Because they fill their lives full of junk so they don't have to think about the big issues anymore. To be honest, I don't have to worry about paying my mortgage at the end of the month. I don't have to worry about whether my wife has bread on the table tomorrow to feed the children while I'm away. I have nothing really to worry about. So I fill my life with junk in order to avoid facing the consequences, the horror of what is to come. So consumerism then, it shapes the whole way we behave, and it's likely to continue indefinitely because politicians, I think, have now latched onto it as the big thing that wins votes. Cynically, one could say, of course it's going to win votes. If you say to people, hey, I'm going to distract you from death so you don't have to worry about the big things of life, people are always going to vote for you. It's a vote winner. It sounds like a cheap joke to say it, but I would say, if you come along and say, I'm going to make you think about death and the judgment to come, pardon the pun, you'll be crucified. You'll be crucified, just as Christ was for saying that. So consumerism then, what affects most of the way people behave in your churches? It's not the new perspective on poor. It's not open theism. It's the fact they have credit cards. Credit cards, easy credit, easy money. Those are things that are impacting the way people behave and think about the world. Moving on from there, I think there are some problems inherent in evangelicalism itself as well. These do not necessarily connect with the first 2 points. I might add, actually, that just as a final point, that there is a connection, I think, between consumerism and the visual culture. The internet is the great interface of those two things. Shoot round from website to website. Look at the ones you want to look at, don't look at the ones you don't want to look at. Buy things online, see a nice picture, those kind of things. There is a connection. I won't bother exploring it further this morning. What are the problems inherent in evangelicalism? Well, the first one is this. And it's one of those problems that is also a strength, I think. But it's a strength we need to appreciate the problems of. And that is evangelicalism emphasizes Christian experience. One of the things that militates against the church being theological is often its emphasis on Christian experience. Why is that the case? Well, prior really to the middle of the 17th century, the church and church membership were pretty well clearly defined along doctrinal lines, I think. If you talk to Luther about conversion, he would have struggled to know exactly what you mean. I'm not making any comment on this as a good or a bad thing, but just to show you the difference in mentality of Luther from many of us today. When the devil comes and tempts Luther, Luther says, you know, sometimes the devil appears in my room and he tempts me. But he says, I send him away because I say I've been baptized. He tells the devil he's been baptized. He doesn't talk about being converted. But that's significant. And in the 16th and 17th century, for reasons, some good, some not so good, the church, the Protestant church, was defined primarily in terms of, do you profess Jesus Christ as Lord? And does your life give any reason to doubt that that's a coherent profession? There was very little interest in the 16th century. It picks up steam in the 17th. Very little interest in the 16th century on, you know, recounting conversions, if you like. When do we hear about Luther's tower experience when he has his breakthrough in the teaching of the Apostle Paul? Well, we hear about it in 1545, and he dies in 1546. So it plays almost no role whatsoever in his theological life. It's just stuck there as part of his autobiography at the start. Why do I say experience is a good thing? Well, it's a good thing because it reminds us that Christianity has to have an impact at an experimental level. The fact that Jesus is Lord is meant to make a difference. The fact that Christ, God loved us in Christ and gave his only begotten Son for us, that has to have an emotional experiential impact upon us. The fact that many of us can think back and know that we live many of years of our lives in rebellion against God, and then turn towards Him at a particular point in time. In my case, it was not on a single day, but over a period of time, we turn back to God. It means it's quite legitimate to talk about conversion, about moving, if you like, from being under God's wrath to being under His grace in our lifetimes. The danger, however, the danger today, I think, is we live in a culture that has become so obsessed with counseling, with therapy, with psychiatry, with psychology, with TV chat shows, to go right back to the first point I made, that there becomes a self-indulgent dimension to experience. And evangelicalism has always had that horrible tendency to allow somebody's experience to ace theological truth. We've all been at those, but I'm not a big small group person, I have to say. I know there are good arguments for it, but I don't want to go to a Bible study where we all sit around and you know, basically share with each other how we don't understand a particular passage. And I don't want to go to a Bible study where, you know, we've all done it. I'm guilty of this myself. When we start our sentence by saying, well, this passage means to me. Passage doesn't mean anything. The passage means something. And if it means it to you, it should mean it to other people as well. If it means it only to you, then it's a kind of Gnostic thing that nobody else can get access to. But evangelicalism, with its emphasis on experience, has always had that element where experience can ace true teaching. And you find this in various ways, and some of which I have sympathy with. You have, well, that particular person, okay, he can understand the Bible in a certain way, but old Mrs. Jones down the road, she's walked with the Lord for 50 years. Mrs. Jones may well have had a great Christian testimony for 50 years, but it may well be the case that she doesn't understand a particular passage of the Bible that somebody with no faith whatsoever understands better than she does. And there's a sense, I get the sense in evangelicalism that we are uncomfortable often with how to connect Christian experience and Christian teaching, if I could put it that way. We often tend to think that somebody's experience validates them to say and do almost anything relative to Scripture. And that, I think, makes evangelicalism dangerously unstable at points. Worst case scenario, sometimes it can lead us to think of the gospel in terms of, well, the gospel is all about transformation of individual lives. Gospel is all about the fact that Jesus Christ, Son of God Most High, came and lived and died on the cross and rose again on the third day for us and for our sins. That's the gospel. It's not about whether you turn to Christ and were no longer an alcoholic or not. Not being an alcoholic is a great collateral benefit of the gospel, but it is not to be identified with the gospel. And individual experiences are not to be identified with the gospel either. Second issue for evangelicalism that I think militates against a strong theological testimony is, again, it's one of these things where it's a strength, but it's also a weakness. There's something really good about it, but there's something problematic about it as well. And that's that evangelicalism is transdenominational. What is good about that is, well, on a theological level, it allows us to give some expression to the unity that all believers have in Christ, to give some expression here and now to that unity. So that's good about it. Secondly, what's good about it, and I speak here as somebody who's sort of intimately connected with numerous evangelical interdenominational bodies, so the criticism I'm making is in some ways a criticism myself at this point. But the second thing that's good about it is it allows for pooling of resources, particularly in a country, United Kingdom and Europe, where evangelicals are, generally speaking, not strong enough in their individual denominations. Even if your denomination is thoroughly evangelical, it would probably be quite small, not strong enough really to achieve very much. Fund missionary enterprises, those kind of things. And part of me is very pragmatic at this point. I know there are those who make very, very strict and strong arguments about missionary societies, that missionary societies must be under the umbrella of a church. And to me, in an ideal world, that is the case. But I also see that much good has been achieved through parachurch transdenominational organizations. The problem, of course, however, is when the transdenominational nature of evangelicalism becomes the driving force. Because if you think about it, as soon as you have Baptists and Peter Baptists working together on something, if that co-belligerence becomes the thing that's driving you, what you're in effect saying is that baptism is not important. And one of my heroes, J. Gresham Machen, who was the founder of Westminster Seminary, wrote a little book called Christianity and Liberalism, which people often read, and rightly, I think, read as major polemic of against liberalism. And that's certainly one thing you can draw from that book. But it's also a major polemic against transdenominational evangelicalism. Because at one point in that book, Machen says, part of the problem is indifference. And he uses the example of Luther and Zwingli. Now, in 1529, a big debate takes place at the castle in a place called Marburg. Philip of Hesse, one of the leading politicians of the time, would like to form a political alliance between Greater Germany and Switzerland. And in order to achieve that in the 16th century, you always need theological agreement as well as political agreement. So he brings together Luther and Zwingli. Luther and Zwingli are at loggerheads because they have different views of the Lord's Supper. Zwingli holds a very strong symbolic view. Bread and the wine are symbols. They are just symbols. That's really all there is to it. Luther has a very strong view that Christ is really humanly present in the bread and the wine. It's not transubstantiation because the bread and the wine are still there. But he's really humanly present in the bread and the wine. And they have this tremendous debate. And it's quite funny if you read the accounts of it. The Lutheran account says, the Zwinglian account says at one point, Zwingli breaks down into tears when he sees there can be no agreement. He breaks down into tears, showing the depth of his sorrow at the breach that is occurring in Protestant Christendom. The Lutheran account says, at some point, Zwingli burst out in crocodile tears, covering up the fact that his secret design to break Protestantism in two was being achieved by his stubbornness. But Machen makes a very interesting comment about that in Christianity and Liberalism. He says it's an absolute tragedy that Luther and Zwingli couldn't agree on the doctrine of the Lord's Supper at that point. He says, but it would have been a greater tragedy if they had agreed to differ. What does he mean by that? Well, what Machen is saying is they'd basically have been saying the Lord's Supper doesn't matter. Okay, we have absolutely fundamental and serious disagreements over the Lord's Supper, but we all know it's a trivial matter, and therefore let's get on with our alliance anyway. Now, maybe many people here say, well, what is the problem with the Lord's Supper? It's not a big issue in British evangelicalism. But the point Machen makes is an interesting one. And that is, as soon as you start bolting together people from different church traditions, you make judgment calls on what is and is not important. And that's fine at the level of a kind of parachurch engagement. But if the parachurch engagement becomes the thing that really starts to drive you and give your identity, make no mistake, you're making critical judgment that certain things that are important are not important. Take an extreme example, evangelicals sharing a co-belligerence platform with Roman Catholics on abortion. I have absolutely no problem with that. I would rather that we did it as individual Christians rather than as representatives of our churches, if you like. But I have no problem with that. But as soon as that co-belligerence were to become a decisive thing in how I started thinking of myself as a Christian, I'd be having to say that an awful lot of what I believe is very important is not very important at all. I was present a few years ago when Tom Oden gave a lecture on the way forward for evangelical unity. And he said, what we need to do is get back to the first five centuries of the church's existence, to the ecumenical consensus of the first five centuries. And I was sitting there thinking, well, that's great if you're Greek Orthodox, because everything of importance to you is there in the first 5 to 7 centuries. Let's take it up to the 7th century, 5 to 7 centuries. But if you're a Catholic or a Protestant, you basically got to say that, well, everything that is dear to me and important to me is not really that important after all. I mean, what Tom Oden was basically saying seemed to me that, well, we can all get on if we all become Eastern Orthodox. I don't think he thought he was saying that, but that seemed to me to be the implication of what he was saying. So the transdenominational nature of evangelicalism is both a strength, but we also need to be careful that it can be a weakness as well. Because it involves an implicit relativizing of those points where we disagree, where perhaps it's important to have principled disagreements, without saying, well, the person who disagrees with me is not necessarily a Christian. Machen's not saying, you know, the disagreement would have indicated that Luther was a Christian and Zwingli wasn't, or vice versa. But we do need to be more, why am I, put it this way, more consciously churchly in the way we think about our engagement as evangelicals. We need to be, first of all, members of our church and stand for what our church stands for and use that as the platform and the basis for our broader engagement at a transdenominational level. To do otherwise, I think, creates a situation where theology is automatically being made very negotiable. Today it's baptism. Maybe tomorrow it's justification by faith. Maybe the day after it's God's knowledge of the future. I'm aware at the moment of the huge debates that are going on here about penal substitution. Is penal substitution something that one can make negotiable? Well, on a co-belligerent platform on abortion, yeah. But in a mission situation, I don't think so. My own personal view is that is not something one can relativize and make negotiable at that level. Third problem with evangelicalism, and that is its lack of historical rootedness. And again, it goes back to a strength in evangelicalism that can also pan out as a weakness. The strength in evangelicalism is this: Scripture is put up front and central. The weakness is that can be used in a way that simply dispatches 2,000 years of church history to the dustbin. Now, I'm not a Roman Catholic, but I would say to you, God has given us the church. And given the choice of looking at what the church, broadly speaking, has said about Scripture over 2,000 years, or looking at what the latest scholarly consensus is, I'm going to give weight to the 2,000 years testimony of the church. Not decisive weight, I'm a Protestant. I don't believe that tradition has some automatic authority where I can't get out from under it. But I do think that tradition has a certain weight and needs to be given a certain credence. To be honest, this is almost a work in process in my own mind. I'm not quite sure exactly how one works that out. But historical rootedness seems to me to be very important. And it was important to the reformers. We often think of the Reformation as a great rebellion against tradition, which it was on this level. Tradition was dethroned as an independent stream of revelation. And tradition was detached from any authoritative statements that the Pope might care to make. But the reformers took very, very seriously the creeds of the early church. They took very, very seriously what theologians had said throughout the ages. When we say, well, the reformers had no book but the Bible, that is true in terms of how they understood revelation. But it is not true in terms of how they did their theological work. You can't open a page of Calvin without finding Augustine dropping out onto your lap. You can't open a page of Owen without finding probably Augustine Aquinas dropping out onto your lap. They were very, very careful to look at what people in the past had said when they approached Scripture. And they were very, very careful to take seriously, particularly seriously, what one might call the communal statements of the church, the creeds of the early church. I used to have a real antipathy to saying the creeds on a Sunday, and I'm still not keen on it. I see Dave smiling there because I know that he says them in his church. I've preached there a couple of times. I'm still not keen on them, but I would say this about the creeds. One of the wonderful things is there's basically nothing in them I disagree with. And in using the words of the creeds, I'm using words that Christians have used throughout history, and I'm kind of standing shoulder to shoulder with them. And I'm saying, we didn't reinvent Christianity on Sunday, this Sunday. We, you know, outsiders have come in. We're not just inventing this as we go along. We're carrying on the tradition in the true sense of the word, the faith that has been handed down to us. So, you know, I'm less hostile to it than I once was. if I can concede that much. But the lack of historical rootedness is problematic. And to me, when does it really come into evangelicalism? It comes into evangelicalism in the 18th century. The evangelical dismissal of history is the result of the impact of the Enlightenment on Protestant theology. Why do I always stand up in my first class at Westminster and say, I know 90% of you don't want to be here. Fortunately, it's a compulsory course on the MDiv, but I'm going to try to persuade you that it's not a complete waste of your time to do my historical courses. Why do I say that? Because I know that most of the people in the class, they come to Westminster, they want to study the Bible. Maybe they want to do systematic theology. And church history is just that thing you have to do to get the professors to sign your degree certificate at the end of the time. It just happens to be in the rules and regulations. But I'm going to say, it's crucially important. It's crucially important to know what Christians have said throughout the ages, when they get it right and when they get it wrong. One of the ways I say to students, I say, even if you can't sympathize with the answers that Christians sometimes give, at least try to sympathize with the questions they're asking. A good example for me is 4th century monasticism. No, I'm not a big monasticism man, I have to say. I think it's basically a wrong way of going about the Christian life. But what's the question being asked there? Christianity has suddenly become respectable. No one's being persecuted for being a Christian anymore. So they're asking themselves, well, the Bible seems to teach us that Christianity's hard. What does being a Christian look like in a society where Christianity is suddenly a respectable career path? That's the question they're asking. They give the wrong answer. But as Christians, I think, it's unworthy of us to say, well, I've nothing to learn from 4th century monasticism. What you have to learn is, they felt the force of that question, and they gave a wrong answer. And the response to that is not to hate monasticism. The response to that is to go away and find the right answer. I'm not a big fan of the ACLU in America, generally speaking, but they have this statement, the response to bad talk, bad speech, is more speech. And the way you deal with the mistakes in church history is doing it right next time. Seeing the mistakes that have been made, doing it right. Evangelicalism, when it cuts itself off from the past, does itself all kinds of disservices, I think, in terms of the way it operates in the present. Further points, the crisis in discipline. Ironically, of course, Protestantism has to take some responsibility directly for the crisis in discipline in the church. When there is only one church, it's easy to discipline people. 1520, December 1520, is the key moment where it all starts to fall apart. The Pope has excommunicated Luther, and the papal bull of excommunication arrives in Wittenberg. It's delivered by the Leipzig militiamen. Because the papacy is so frightened of getting beaten up on its way through electoral Saxony, they hand it over to the heavies in Leipzig to deliver it. And the bull is delivered in Wittenberg, and what does Luther do? He parades out with the bull of excommunication and the book of canon law, and he burns them. Not that he's into censorship. Luther's brilliant. When people write against him, he doesn't ban their books. Quite often, he republishes them with forewords by himself, telling you where they got it wrong. Yeah, it seems to be a very, you know, an ACLU response. He subverts them. So why does he burn these things? Because he's particularly burning the canon law. He's demonstrating he no longer accepts the authority of the church. Dramatic. To me, that's the moment the Reformation really begins, if you like. That's the moment of high drama that we look for in church history. But it's also the moment, one might say, when the church's bluff is called on discipline. And of course, we now live in a situation where how, as pastors, do you operate in terms of discipline? You are utterly dependent upon the individual that you approach to discipline, A, being a member of the church, which cannot be taken for granted these days. A lot of people will not become members. It's not biblical to be a member of a church. Well, I would say you don't find the word church membership in the New Testament, but you cannot have pastors operating as they do in the New Testament unless there's some kind of equivalent of church membership. Person has to be a church member, and secondly, there has to be teeth in church discipline. You are utterly dependent upon the person caving in the first time you confront them. Tragic example of the church I used to be at in Nottingham. This happened since the time I've left. Well, I phoned up a friend. I like to keep in touch with what's happened at the church, and I phoned up, or he phoned me, a good friend phoned me the other week to fill me in, and The guy that I used to meet, I've always been a big believer in accountability, that there should be somebody that you meet with that you can talk about anything with and will hold you accountable. You pray with that person. I think it's important to do it one-to-one because group setting, it becomes a kind of a, can become a kind of Oprah Winfrey thing, I think, and everybody's trying to outdo everybody else and the bad things they've done or whatever. But one-to-one, it's very appropriate. And I found out that the person that I used to be, you know, I'd meet to pray with and be accountable with, left his wife and taken up with somebody else. So and I said to my friend, so he doesn't come to church anymore. He said, well, no, he said, he goes to the church down the road. And that captures in a nutshell the whole problem. Say what you like about the medieval church, but if you committed adultery, the priest could have sanctioned you and there'd be nothing you could do about it. You'd be stuck. You couldn't just hop over the wall to the next parish because the priest there would have been briefed on you and he wouldn't give you the mass either. The problem we face today is, and ironically, it's a product of the Great Reformation. The problem we face today, I think, the biggest crisis is that indiscipline. How do you discipline somebody? If they're an office bearer, it can be, it's more straightforward because the standards for an office bearer are set somewhat higher than they are often for an ordinary church member. But even so, what do you do with that person who says, forget it, I'm going down to the church down the road? There's nothing you can do. And I don't have any answer to that. I have no answer whatsoever to that. But I would suggest that's one of the key problems facing the church today at a theological level and a moral level. Discipline is virtually impossible. And so often we cast discipline now, and you think about it, it's so typical of the evangelical world, we tend to think of discipline in trans-denominational terms now. Is Steve Chalk still going to be a legitimate member of the Evangelical Alliance? Well, I want to say to you, biblically, that question's irrelevant. Evangelical Alliance has no status, as far as I'm concerned, biblically. It's a great gathering of like minds to do great things. What I'm concerned about is Steve Chalk a member of a church? And I'm not making a judgment one way or the other on that, but I'm saying that's the question we should be asking. Somebody who's committed adultery, how do you deal with that? I don't want to paint a particularly bleak picture, but I have no answers to that one. And again, it tracks back to consumerism. Why do people go to church? They go to church to look for what they want to look for. I'm in a strange situation now in Philadelphia, and the first time in my life, there are 25 or 30 churches within 20 miles of my front door that I could go to. When I lived in the UK, with the exception of when I was in a university town as a student, there was no choice about where I went to church. One could ultimately not be that fussy about styles of worship. One could ultimately not be that fussy about details of church government or whatever. You just went to the church where the gospel was preached. And that was in some ways a good thing because it crystallized in your mind central things about choosing which church to go to. I now live in a place where, I could choose, well, if I don't like the kind of worship at this church, I can go to another one. You should never leave a church for any other reason than there is gross immorality or gross heresy being tolerated in the pulpit. I'm a pretty traditional guy on worship, but the introduction of a praise band would not be sufficient for me to surrender my membership of a church. Is the gospel being preached and is moral discipline being properly applied? Those are the marks of the church. So the crisis in discipline tracks to consumerism. So often, particularly in the States, maybe it doesn't apply so much here, but we go to the church because of how it meets our needs. We're not going there to place ourselves under the authority of the local session and under the authority of the man preaching the word. And I don't know how we deal with that. Because, independence, you've got Presbyterians, but even we all know there are various Presbyterian denominations. You could leave the Free Church of Scotland and go and move to Paul's Church, for example. Free Church of Scotland has no jurisdiction over who Paul brings into church membership. Does it, Dave? I don't think. There you are. There's the problem in a nutshell. The problem is not just one for independence. It's one across the board for evangelicalism. And that leads me to my very final point. I'll just end. That, I think, means that we face a serious collapse in moral accountability in our churches. that is far more serious, I think, than the impact of open theism or new perspective at this point. Serious as those things are, the collapse in moral accountability is the thing that most potentially damages the church. And without, you know, let me sound very pessimistic at this point, I see no way forward. You know, I like to, good thing about being a historian, I always say to people, I just analyze the problems of the past and maybe down to the present day. Theologians and biblical scholars, they're the guys who've got to come up with the answers. So I'm just being a good historian here. Moral accountability has collapsed in our churches, and our structures militate against us solving that problem. But we do need to solve it. And I have no insight on how that can be done. I have 5 minutes just to take some questions of clarification. And yeah. I would agree. The question is unity in essentials. What was the second part? I can't remember the exact. Liberty in inessentials, in all things charity. I would agree, absolutely. The question then becomes, what are the essentials? And Machen's point is, who told you that the Lord's Supper is not an essential? I would say, this is where the history of the church becomes very important. I can read the Bible and I can try to work out the important things for myself. But I can also look at the history of the church. And the history of the church seems to me to be a very good guide to the things that people have considered important and essential. Maybe if I'd read the New Testament, I'd never have thought that the Lord's Supper is something I really have to wrestle with. But I look at church history and, wow, this has been significant. Now, maybe the church has been wrong in making it significant. But if I'm going to come to that conclusion, I first of all have to look at the arguments the church has made, weigh them in the balance scripturally, and then decide, well, actually, Machen's wrong. It would have been okay to have totally relativized it. But you make that decision, I think, by listening to the testimony of the church, or the churches, plural, should I say, over the ages, and then making a judgment in light of Scripture. So there's no magic formula for doing it. Tom Oden's response would be, well, the creeds, you know, the Athanasian and the Nicene Creed, they tell you what's really important. So we're not at liberty to make quite that judgment. We need to look at the Council of Trent. We need to look at the Westminster Confession, Baptist Confession of 1689. There are a whole host of other confessions that churches, all claiming to be the true church, have put forward since then. And we need to weigh each of those as well. We can't simply go back to the 5th century at this point. So it's difficult, and this is where I think history and historical theology become important for us. You might say, you would say that, wouldn't you? As far as the charity goes, one of the points I'm going to make in the final lecture, and this is something that I've not myself been good at over the years, the emergence of the concept of humble orthodoxy in some parts of the church in North America, I find very attractive. Partly because I stand convicted by it a lot of the time. But I think that there is a need for more charitable engagement on these things than has often been the case. Yeah? Yeah, I've tried each of the disadvantages I've pointed to. I've tried to point out that there's also a strength. You know, there's something good to be said about it, as well as something bad to be said about it. 27,000 denominations. Part of me might want to respond and say that's wonderful, because it shows that people really believe that things matter, and that's why, you know, I like to be provocative sometimes and say I'm a big fan of denominations, because it tells me that people take things seriously. So I might give a positive response. I say, that's great, because it shows that people still believe that important things matter. And it's more important to be wrong but realize they matter than simply to brush them to one side. On the other side, I would say, well, sounds very much like a shopping mall to me. In any given location, sounds like a shopping mall. And I see this at, you know, Westminster Seminary. You know, there's RTS, there's Covenant, and they're our brothers in the Lord, striving for the extension of the kingdom. They're also our rivals. You know, we keep a close eye on how they market themselves and how they talk about us. And we're, you know, We have a marketing department, and you know, the church can get like that. So I would want to say, don't want to sound too Anglican at this point, but there's a good thing and a bad thing about that. I'm good, it's sort of, yeah, it strikes me, it's great. People still believe in stuff. Yeah. Although Paul's factionalism there, I think, I read that more as a kind of first sign of the old celebrity culture kicking in. So I'm not sure that it's so doctrinal at that point as it is, Cephas is better looking than Paul, and he speaks better than him, and I'm a Cephas man. You know, if there are two guys preaching in town, you've got to go and hear Cephas because he's that much more impressive than Paul. So I tend to read Corinthians as a first start of the dreadful celebrity culture kicking into the church.
I'm
inclined to say that's well outside of my brief for these three lectures, but one would say in North America, no. That's not a non-essential because it goes to the heart of dispensation. You know, when you arrive in the States from the UK, one of the things that most staggers you is eschatology is important. You know, I rarely heard about eschatology in the UK, but it's the dividing line in America. Well, like I say, if I was the pastor of a church and I had amillennialists, postmillennialists, and dispensationalists in the congregation, it wouldn't particularly worry me as a discipline matter. Would not appoint a dispensationalist to church office. I'd go as far as to say that. Because then you make another distinction, I think, within the church that I would say it's important for the church to set the bar for church membership as low as possible. If you say Jesus is Lord and your life gives me no reason to doubt that that's the case, I see no reason to deny you church membership. If you want to be an office bearer, I'm going to set the bar incredibly high. And that, you know, the churches I like are the ones where membership, the level is low for members, and office bearing, the level is high. So for me, the essentials, inessentials, how that connects with discipline also connects to who you are in the local church. I think if I was in a denomination where there were dispensationalists, saying, for example, they signed the Westminster Confession of Faith, but holding office, I would be inclined to investigate that quite closely. It wouldn't bother me that we dispensationalists as members in a church that signed up to the Westminster Confession of Faith.